You're listening to Security Wire Weekly, a SearchSecurity.com podcast for July 16th, 2008. Welcome to the program. I'm Rob Westervelt, and this edition we're going to talk with well-known network security researcher Dan Kaminsky about his recent discovery of the DNS server flaw, how it was handled, and what you should do if you've got a DNS server issue. Also, Rich Mogul, founder of independent information security consulting firm Securosis, joins us. Rich talks about how the DNS server flaw plays into the whole flaw disclosure discussion, and also how the process was handled. In a moment, my interview with Dan Kaminsky and Rich Mogul, but first, this message.
There's analysts, there's industry experts, and there's the Security Squad. In a monthly podcast series, the writers and editors of SearchSecurity.com and Information Security Magazine debate today's hot-button security issues. Everything from the demise of network access control to terrorism to the merits of compliance. No topic is out of bounds. Join the discussion. Download Security Squad and our other great podcast today. Go to searchsecurity.com/podcast. That's searchsecurity.com/podcast.
We're talking to a well-known network security researcher, Dan Kaminsky. If you haven't heard already, Dan has made a discovery, this DNS server flaw. Dan is director of penetration testing at IOActive, and he's a frequent speaker at industry conferences. And he's probably best known for his Black Ops talks at the annual Black Hat briefings. Kaminsky is formerly with Cisco and Avaya, and he's also an advocate, a well-known advocate for net neutrality. Rich Mogul is also joining us. Rich is founder of independent information security consultant firm Securosis, and he's a former analyst and vice president at Gartner. He's covered issues ranging from vulnerabilities and threats to risk management frameworks to major application security. Dan, why should IT administrators care about issues with DNS? Aren't gateways considered unsafe anyways?
Well, in the real world, we do not always use encryption. I mean, you know, yes, in theory, you should always distrust your gateway. The reality is, no, you do. You sort of assume there's not a bad guy between you and what you're looking for. Look at how much of the web is not over SSL. Look at email. It's 2008. We really just are not using secure email. And so because of this, DNS has remained something of the core of trust for Internet security. DNS is basically the Internet's equivalent of 411. You give it a name, and it gives you a number back. The Internet doesn't run on names any more than the telephone network does. You need to have something's number. Now, we assume that the numbers we get back are correct and accurate and will actually route us to the destination we choose. But that is something of an assumption, and it depends on DNS not having problems in order for that assumption to be correct. What was recently discovered, and I can't go into too much details about how, what was recently discovered is that it is trivial for an attacker to remap DNS to cause it to provide attacker addresses instead of good guy addresses.
Mm-hmm. These DNS servers are pretty old school, right? These servers are very well ingrained within organizations. Do IT administrators, have they maintained them over the years? Have they been in the background and been off the radar, so to speak?
The data suggests that they tend to be in the background. I mean, one of my things is I do a lot of large-scale network scans, and I basically find out what's out there on the Internet. And a lot of what I find is a lot of servers that are vulnerable, not even to the newly discovered stuff, but are actually vulnerable to old stuff, too. You got to realize a name server is basically a database that automatically populates a cache out of some hosts on the Internet. This, long story short, servers can sometimes run themselves. This is the first time we've had a bug that is so severe that I'm asking a lot of people in corporate environments to, go that old crusty box that's at the core of your network that just always works and always runs, you don't think about? You know what? You got to think about it.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that in a moment, kind of working with these vendors. Very interested in that. But this flaw could eventually lead to DNS cache poisoning. Why don't you describe that to us, and then what really the threat is to the average company?
Well, the thing to realize is that the internet is really ingrained in modern business processes. So what if the internet wasn't the internet? In other words, what if you went to websites and, man, I don't know what you're seeing, but it's not what you're looking for. Well, what we're looking at is really a large potential for large-scale compromise of an entire company's perception of the web. And you also got to consider email. You send an email, you send a contract down. It's probably not encrypted. Real world, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Where's that contract going? What if it's going to a competitor? What if it's going to a bad guy? I mean, this is real world. The integrity of your data flows is really at risk.
How can you tell if you're really affected by the problem? Is it very simple? I know you have a website that you've set up, a DNS checker.
Yes. So if you go to www.doxpara.com, whatever name server your desktop is configured to use, even if it's behind the firewall, I can go ahead and take a look at it and tell you if it is safe or not. But www.doxpara.com, upper right-hand corner, there's a button. Push the button, it'll tell you if you're safe or not.
Sure. Now, the average IT pro doesn't need to do that, right? Do they? What do they have to start with?
So the big deal here is there's absolutely reason for concern. I mean, the flaw is bad. But I have to give credit to all the vendors who really came together. So we had an unprecedented cooperation of software vendors who came together to do a unified patch, to do one class of fix, different implementations, obviously, but one class of fix, one day, July 8th, doesn't matter if you're running a Cisco name server, a Microsoft name server, a Bind name server, a Sun name server, a Red Hat name server, everyone's got patches. So if you're not patched, go out, get patched. Now, even after you patch, one of the things we're finding out now is there are sometimes interactions with firewalls that may be on networks. So your PIX firewall, your net screen, things like this may require a little bit of extra configuration or setup to not interfere with the what we've done, source port randomization. So first, IT administrators need to actually first find the servers in your network. I mean, these things run themselves, so often you'll have little clusters that just happen to depend on some particular name servers. You can scan your internal networks. You can actually run sniffs on your inside-to-outside link to find, show me all the name servers that my company is depending on. You can remediate through there. The second step is once you find them and patch them, or move off of them if they're unpatched and external, then you go ahead and still take a look and make sure that your firewall or gateway is not interfering with the randomness. If it's not random, you're going to be just as vulnerable.
Explain that randomness. What do you mean by that?
All right. So there were many fixes that we could have taken in order to address this issue. The path that we chose involved the fact that there is a 16-bit identifier in DNS called the transaction ID. And what we decided to do is we decided to supplement the 16-bit transaction ID with also the 16 bits of randomness that's in the UDP source port. Now, IP is a layered protocol. You know, everything runs in layers. We have a random identifier at the application layer inside of DNS. Turns out there was a potential for a random identifier at layer 4 at UDP. And so we decided to take advantage of the possibility of using this layer 4 identifier in addition to layer 7, and we are now going to have between 27 and 30 bits of entropy as opposed to the existing 16, which is nice.
And that makes it much more difficult for an attacker?
It does make it much more difficult. It does not make it impossible, but it gets us out of the immediate attack trouble we're in right now.
And then is there a long-term fix planned that we may not know about?
Oh, there's going to be an entertaining debate about the long-term fix that needs to be done here. You know, some factions are going towards DNSSEC. Some factions are going towards something called XQID. There are various things that have been suggested, and I welcome the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But we needed something that we could get out the frickin' door. You know, one of my friends has a great quote. He's like, I'm not a surgeon. I'm a medic. well, you know, this is us being a meta. We're going to try to patch this up so that the, you know, the network integrity maintains itself to a reasonable degree. But we're in some trouble.
All right.
And this is the process we're taking to fix it.
Right. Just for the IT administrator, how should patches be treated? Are most of them automated at this point? Should they be treated like any other patch?
So Microsoft platform's automated, which is very nice. A lot of these servers do not run on systems with automated patch management, but, you know, it's not a very difficult patch to install. The regression rate should be very low on the server side. It may require visiting some boxes. It may require finding whoever manages this particular IP address. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I mean, I'm here telling corporate administrators, as someone who, you know, I used to work, I was a network engineer before I was a security engineer. I mean, I know I'm making a big ask here. I'm asking people to modify servers that are the core of their network. I'm asking people, man, if this thing goes down, you're going to have some angry phone calls from some C-levels. But, you know, this thing gets hacked. You're still going to get some angry phone calls. Yes, actually go through change management, pull the alarm. This matters.
You had to get all of these vendors together into one room. Talk a little bit about that. Was that a difficult process, especially, you know, as a security researcher from that perspective? It's kind of interesting you had to work with each and every vendor there.
I think it's amazing how much better things have gotten. I mean, I've been in this game from the beginning when vendors barely talk to you, and, you know, it's just a different world now. Microsoft was great. They're like, sure, no problem. We will totally host a summit for you. Just tell us when. We'll do all the arrangements.
We should say this was back in March, right?
Yeah. So I notified Paul Vixie in late February. And Vixie and I started pulling in something of a cabal to figure out what we were going to do about this, and quickly realized we're going to have to meet in person and come to a decision here, or, you know, this isn't going to work. Email is great, but if you want a decision, sometimes you just got to meet in person. So from late February to late March, we had a summit arranged, plane tickets purchased, everyone came. And we had three things we had to do. We had to, first of all, understand the problem, because it's a messy one. Then we had to go ahead and figure out, what are we going to do about it? Which fix are we going to select? And we happened to select this particular fix we're 1 week in. We're 7 days in, and there are no exploits out there. That's pretty cool. So people have not figured it out yet. They will. I mean, I honestly will be somewhat surprised if this actually makes it the entire 30 days. Mm-hmm. I'll be thankful, because it means a lot of people are not going ahead and discussing this on public lists. They're keeping their research to themselves. I appreciate that. I can't demand it. I can barely even expect it, but I can ask and I can hope. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. we're trying to... So that was the goal of that particular fix.
What was the
The third thing was the date. We needed to get the date synchronized.
Date synchronized. Now, what was the tone, though, of that summit? And can you kind of describe the setting there and whether there was a debate over... Was there a debate, and was it a democratic process to decide?
Yeah, you know, it totally was a democratic process. There was a vote. We had a, you know, hey, guys, do we think this is actually going to pull it off?
Uh-huh.
You got to realize, we're engineers. And when we walked in that room, it didn't matter what company we worked for. It didn't matter what company we worked with. It didn't matter who wrote the broken name server in the past. All that mattered is, in some way, we'd all screwed up. And we were all in trouble. And we all had to get out of this alive. So that hones the mind very, very nice. You know, there's a lot of discussion. There's a lot of math that went back and forth as we ran the numbers on what would work, what we thought would work. There's a lot of, you know, you really think you can get your engineers to do this? And then we're like, yes, we will pull that off. So it wasn't trivial. But, I mean, it's 2008, and the vendors were just incredibly, incredibly responsive. People were flying in from all over the world to figure out what we needed to do here. And you know what? They did it. How angry would we be at Microsoft, at ISC, at Cisco, at all of these companies, if they had not taken this matter seriously. It would have been like, you guys have been irresponsible and haven't done what is needed to protect people. Well, you know what? They were responsible. They did an unprecedented amount of cooperation, and I'm really thankful for that.
Rich, have you ever seen anything like that?
No, I mean, we've never seen this level of cooperation before. Even previously, when we've seen vulnerabilities that were cross-platform vulnerabilities, to my knowledge, this is the first time where we were actually able to get everybody together, or Dan was able to get everybody together and come up with a synchronized solution. I'll give you an example. You know, a while ago, there were a bunch of SNMP vulnerabilities, and the vendors were unable to all cooperate and unable to issue simultaneous releases, and then the information got leaked. And we started seeing vulnerability details and exploits as everybody rolled through their patches on their own schedule.
With a system such as this, a DNS server, aren't there some industry standard groups out there? Isn't there some sort of way that these different DNS vendors communicate to each other?
Well, I mean,
we have lists. We have ways of talking to each other, obviously. I mean, every industry has this, but there's one thing to have discussions. There's another thing to, you know, ship code. And I think the important thing here is really we shipped code and did it on the same day.
Mm-hmm.
You were saying, Rich? I'm sorry for interrupting.
Oh, no problem. I was saying, I mean, DNS is a core standard. It's not something that gets messed with on a regular basis, and there are the standards committees, but it's not like people are looking at making changes to a standard that's been around and stable for a fairly long period of time. So, even when you have groups like that, not necessarily every vendor who's using DNS needs to participate or would participate. So that's another reason this is definitely a little bit unprecedented.
Mm-hmm. What was the federal government's role, Dan, and did you get them involved initially?
So the federal government was involved through CERT, and they were involved. We brought one of the guys from CERT came out to the summit. So, you know, we've obviously kept them in the loop, and they did their job fantastically. Like, because you've got to realize there are various rings involved in DNS. There's a fairly limited number of implementations that are popular. And so those were the guys who were in the room. The second ring were the people who ship all of the various implementations. So Sun, Red Hat, Debian, all of these guys. They weren't necessarily there, but the people in them who pay attention were either double duty within the room or very, very closely connected. CERT did the bulk of the lifting on getting everyone who happened to ship, at least getting notifications out that people should pay attention to this, covered a lot of making sure that DOD knew what was going on, coordinated with other CERTs around the world. So, I mean, this was a huge partnership of a lot of people. I think this is the first I've seen that industry collaboration can make a genuine difference in the security of the Internet.
And
I think that's really cool.
Sure. Sure. And this goes beyond just DNS servers, right? Other vendors are going to have to come on board here and upgrade firewalls, for example, right?
Yes. So we do have some issues where our fix for the name servers is interacting in a not the most pleasant of manners with some of the default behavior on firewalls and such. And so
I think we saw what Microsoft had an issue with one of the vendors. I can't think of the name of it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. There were some issues on the client side fixed with Zone Alarm, which are working themselves out. I mean, it's certainly not good, but it's something that happens.
Mm-hmm. And is it going to take any coordinated release with these other vendors on this other level?
I can certainly say that, look, we invented this process as we went along. We've never even tried something of this scale.
Uh-huh.
We did it all over again. Certainly, there would be more collaboration, more heads up to the firewall vendors across the board. I mean, I think that's something that that could have been done a little differently. Also, something that could have been done differently was I really didn't have anyone else from the security community on board. Like, I had the entire vendor community, I had all the DNS people, but I didn't have any other hackers. And hackers are a very skeptical lot, as they need to be, as they completely need to be.
Sure.
Because it's just so easy to make stuff up. I can't say it enough. I mean, you know, you could say that if you typed 8 characters just in right timing into Internet Explorer, your machine blew up. And, if, you know, the press would report it. Be like, no, I can't tell you the 8 characters. It's security, you know. So I understand the skepticism. I relate to it. I apologize for at least not having some other uninvolved security engineers on board. That, I think, was a really big thing at the beginning of this. I ended up finally getting a phone call with Tom Patchick of Modisano Security and Dino Dizovi as well. And you know, they were pretty strong detractors, and then I laid it out for them.
Why did you reverse that? I know you sort of just explained a little bit, but you initially didn't share your discovery with any security researchers, including trusted ones, and then you decided to give Thomas and Dino a call.
Well, thank you. Got to admit when you make a mistake. You know, Tom called. I called Tom the day before he started all the big blogs. And he just asked me point blank what the bug was, and I'm like, oh, you know, I gotta be paranoid. Vendors. Yeah, you know what? I should have just told him right then and there. It would have made my life a lot easier, and it would have been the right thing to do. So, I mean, at the end of the day, Tom Patchick is brilliant. I mean, his original paper on bypassing IDSs to this day is still one of the better works of our entire industry. So, I should have trusted him to keep things quiet, as he has, and vouch for the issue, which he also has. So, you know, it's a process. You learn as you go. This went pretty well.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be difficult, though, right? I mean, did it even come across your mind that you needed to eventually share? Or, I mean, what was the process, the thought process, when you first discovered the flaw? Because you said that it was sort of discovered by accident, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, basically, I just started thinking about... actually, I just started remembering back to some of my times when I was first at Cisco and was really doing network engineering stuff, where I'm like, what am I asking people to do? Like, this isn't a small ask. This is some serious demands that I'm putting on people's time. How do I get this through change management? How do I get this to be something that is not just me sounding an alarm and ha ha, you silly guys with your corporate processes, you now got a deal. I know those corporate processes. I've done those corporate processes. I've complained when those corporate processes were not followed. So what could I do to benefit them as much as possible? And so really it was, first of all, let's get Paul Vixie involved, because the man is an institution, and he knows everyone who's done anything in DNS ever, since he's been doing it since I've been in grade school. You know, and then from there, let's go ahead and pull some people in and see if we can actually get agreement on a simultaneous patch.
Right.
I didn't know if I could get the agreement, but I had to try. And it turns out, and to my great somewhat shock and absolute appreciation, yeah, people were actually down for, you know, it was March and we were talking August or maybe July and maybe even June. And so, you know, that was a time scale that people could actually get patches out on. I mean, the one thing that I have to say that the security community does not get is that testing takes time. And it is a real problem to think that you can get patches. You can get code written overnight, but getting code, you have any idea that it works? That cannot be done in a couple of days. And, you know, I think a lot of people in the security community do not realize that it does actually take a genuine and expensive and painful engineering effort to do a lot of these things. It's why you want to write good code in the first place.
Rich, what's this say for the flaw discovery process and, you know, revelation to vendors, the whole security researcher? You know, we've been talking about this for some time. Does this really reflect on anything? Can you talk about that?
So you mean the disclosure process?
Disclosure, exactly. Sorry.
Yeah, you know, the disclosure has been just a very contentious issue across the industry that to this day, I mean, as long as I've been working in security, there's been debates on disclosure, and it hasn't ended yet. Basically, there's kind of a camp that believes when you discover something, you should make it as widely public as possible right in the beginning. Some people even believe that you don't need to notify vendors ahead of time. It's kind of a part of that full disclosure crowd. And, you know, maybe in the old days, it might have made a little bit of sense. They say, you know, that's the only way vendors will fix problems. Well, I think Dan just proved that that's not the only way that vendors are going to go ahead. That the vendors, you know, definitely always need that threat of full disclosure out there. Then the other side is what we call responsible disclosure. And that's what Dan did in this case, which is where when a vulnerability is discovered, you notify the vendors and you get other people involved. Now, there's a little bit of a side. There are vendors out there who tend to ignore responsible disclosure. I don't want to pick on any in particular, but I know vendors that have held on to bugs that have been reported to them for a matter of years. So there's this really uneasy balance. The vendors hate people looking at their products and finding bugs, or most of the vendors out there. And they don't really view all security researchers as professionals, which most of them are these days. And on the other side, there's the people who are doing the research who, you know, there's gradient levels of responsibility within that community. And some people handle things well, and some people mishandle things and expose things that they shouldn't do. I think this is a great, great case of when things of how things can work correctly. The way Dan discovered something, reported it, the vendors responded, got everybody involved, and they released the patch. And the full details will come out later. I think that's a necessary part of the process, that people are given time to patch. You know, one of my things that upset me when people were criticizing Dan for not releasing all the details of the vulnerability was like, you know, guys, if the vendors release patches and they all agree to do this, it's not your responsibility to validate this research. At this point, you know, take it or leave it, that information will come out later, but if Dan releases it now, the bad guys are going to be able to turn this around way faster than the good guys can patch, because it takes us time to, as we were talking about before, to get our infrastructure updated.
And does this say anything about the patching process? There was some research that came out earlier this year talking about how maybe the patching process needs to be revamped. Do you agree with that? Does it say anything about the patching process?
Well, you know, the patching processes really have been a mess for a number of years in a lot of organizations. Now, the vendors take as much blame for this as the end users. A lot of vendor patches, the quality of those patches isn't always the best. And as a result, as we were talking about before again, organizations really do need, you know, they can't just take a vendor at their word that the patch works. They really have to do very high levels of testing. And that takes time. It's not something you turn around overnight. Now, on the other hand, there are, sure, Dan and I work a lot with, like, the Fortune 500, the really big companies with a lot of great, you know, processes and resources. There's, like, whole swaths of the rest of the world that doesn't have the ability to go do regression testing on patches in their own environment and those sorts of things. And I do think we need better tools, better capabilities for those in the market that don't have the resources to go ahead and do full testing and everything on the patches themselves. And then I think we also need, in some cases, recognition that we do need formalized patch management for all of our infrastructure, not just something like your Microsoft desktop. And people do need to make sure that they start developing a process for that if they don't already have one, so they can get those things out quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It's messy because it's hard. I mean, you know, maybe some of the patches work, some of them don't. You're looking at breaking systems, and no vendor is going to know every circumstance you're using their product. It's an ugly world out there, and I'll be honest, I don't expect it to get, you know, materially better anytime soon, but I think if you get a good process, that can really help a lot.
Hey, Dan, it's been only a short time since the patches were released. Any thoughts on deployment times thus far and what you're seeing out there?
I can say that I've gone out and talked to some of my bigger clients and said, hey, you know, have you guys seen this and paid attention to it? And I have to say I'm really pleased. Like, all of them, it's either they're already patched or they've got someone who's on board with it, who's actually in the process of it. I mean, I can't, without things on fire, you're not going to get patches, you know, overnight. The whole point was to not have things on fire, was to get a controlled patching experience for people. can we as a community somehow create something where we do find a problem that threatens the infrastructure and we don't, you know, threaten the actual infrastructure during the fixing process? And I'm pretty proud. I think people are concerned. People are beginning processes. I wish I could tell you the major websites that are major companies that have actually gotten on board with this. People who aren't already patched are getting patched. I mean, it's happening, and it's beautiful to watch, and warms my heart.
Dan, you addressed this briefly, and I wanted you to go a little deeper into it. There obviously has been some skepticism among security researchers. One reverse software engineer, for example, called this a bit overhyped, and he said, he congratulated you for discovering the bug, and he said, he's sure it's a legitimate bug, but the average user should always assume that the gateway is owned. This is why we have SSL certificates and don't use plain text protocols. He also talked about that we've survived repeated bind remote exploits, SSH remote exploits, and a good number of open SSL remote exploits. So what makes this one so different? And I know you can't go into it, but...
I really can't, I can't defend myself here adequately because I can't go into all the bugs because I'm trying to keep people safe here. And that sounds like such a cop-out, but I will put it this way. If you have 100% of your network communication using SSL and you're always using certificates correctly and you're always doing everything great, all right, you get to ignore this fix. You get to feel great and smug and happy. But for the rest of the world, you might want to fix your name servers.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for your time, both of you gentlemen, Rich Mogul and Dan Kaminsky. Thanks very much.
All right. Bye now.
Well, that does it for this edition of Security Wire Weekly. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information at our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. For now, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.